Thank you for watching Conscious Consumer Network. The live stream broadcast is free to view. You can pause and rewind live broadcasts to catch up, or view shows at a later date by accessing our free archives of all shows. Check out our broadcast guide to see what's on. You can show your support by donating to our network support fund. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or subscribe to the monthly newsletter for updates. We thank you for supporting free and independent media.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode number 43 of Unspun. Tonight, Joe Atwill is out sick. I was the one out sick week before last. Now he's feeling under the weather again. And today we're joined by the infamous Dr. Hans Utter. Hans, how are you?
Fantastic. Doing very well.
Well, you know, and I've got to apologize for the delay. I've had so much going on getting part two done. I was editing it today, got a good chunk of it edited. We had a pretty good error in there. That I mentioned to you the other day on the phone. I was able to get that cleaned up. But, and we were just kind of joking around, rock and roll and mind control. So today, like usual, we're probably going to discuss rock and roll and mind control. What did you have in mind for today, Hans?
Well, really nothing. My mind has gone completely blank. I've been listening to Richard Hell all day.
Did you play any rap music too by chance?
No, I'm about to actually, I'm playing with this R&B band about to go on a tour. So I'm learning all this material. So it's a little bit, getting into that from the other side. There's definitely some interesting stuff from the gospel end, but it's kind of fun for me, or it depends on what I'm doing, but, I get to intersect with different worlds and, I got to put food on the table and, I'd rather have free food and have handouts and have lots of fractional reserve derivatives that I could just, I thought about becoming a human bank, I just become a bank and just create my own currency and, it's all good, but, I'll just throw some stuff at you just to begin with, some stuff that I was just thinking about connected with the idea, the Native American church, but just a little bit some deeper underpinnings.
Yeah, did you catch our episode last week exposing that?
You know what? I didn't. I've been traveling and just, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay, because, let me give you a quick rundown on what Joe and I covered last week, because that might give you some information regarding peyote and the Native American church this week. But essentially, what we see is just like the word Teonanacatl comes out of the Florentine Codex and from the Aztecs, peyote or peyotl also comes from the Florentine Codex. And the Huichol, where we get most of the peyote usage from today, they use the word hikuri or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so it essentially what appears is that in the mid to late 1850s is when we first see the Native Americans begin to use peyote. And then what happens is in 1890, 1891, Kuwana Parker, I forget the last name, and Cynthia Parker, who was the white woman who was kidnapped by the Comanche. She had later married the Comanche chief, and they had Kuwana Parker. Kuwana Parker in 1891, the official story goes, he's in Texas, and he gets gored by a bull, and then a shaman comes up from Mexico, and then Kuwana Parker promotes the Native American church after that to all the other tribes. Meanwhile, he's also hanging out with the likes of Teddy Roosevelt, and he becomes the de facto chief of the Comanche, not by election of the Comanche, but by appointment of the U.S. government.
Yeah. Well, that's that's fascinating. That actually ties in a little bit what I wanted to bring up. I do have some little bit more detailed information that we'll either cover another time, but I want to talk a little about the intellectual grounding or frameworks of this stuff, right? Because you sent me a link for that Gordon Wasson website, and what that shows is that this stuff was very high level, right? This was not just some, you know, throwaway project, say, you know, MK Ultra stuff, the LSD experimentation, but this stuff had very deep roots, right? Wasson, as long, that website, at least, if that, all that stuff is verified, I mean, this guy was linked in on the deepest possible level, right, to promote the mushrooms. And so, you know, this brought to mind the underpinnings of philosophy on society, something that has been subverted or hidden. Right now, we're living in a postmodern society. We're living in a society that's created by the postmodern coup of 9/11. We're living in a society of narrative warfare. We have this narrative of the war on terror. We have an actual input, you know, the utilization of these philosophical concepts, actually an inversion of Plato. I've been reading The Republic again. Everyone always bashes Plato, but he says the most fundamental thing in the Republic is freedom. It should be full freedom within your ability to act, within your skill level. And they talk, they compare men and women, and they say, you know, is it not true that certain women exceed men? Yes. Is it not true, you know, women excel in certain arts like baking and all this stuff? But the fact is that they talk about the level of each person, the maximum potential they can reach, and not allowing people to get a hold of the reins of power if they have not developed you call it a moral compass, an ethical sense or whatever. But we're living in a philosophical state which is created from the, you know, all the Chicago school and all the neocons won't get and all that, but this is basically, we are living in a utilization of a model of philosophy that has completely changed our culture, right? There's no more truth. As soon as you go into postmodernism, you have relativity on steroids, right? There is no truth. There's no single reality. You have this idea from Derrida that everything is a text that can be interpreted, the death of the author, right? It's just a text, and each reader is going to have their own reading of that text, and all it is just this confluence of all these multiple truths, and so there's really no reality. And a philosopher who I used to like quite a bit, Deleuze, talks about this state as the body without organs, a state of total externality, which is all basically where you just float between taking on different identities, playing with different identities. There's no truth, right? So this idea of, this is what we have, constant falsehood, constant lies, but at the same time, the interdiction of this grand master narrative. So this is completely a philosophically derived state that we live in.
Think of the promotion of quantum physics and all of this stuff by Amit Goswami and all of these guys. You can't know anything. None of these guys agree. They use terms like religion and magic and science for this. And what quantum physics is rather than going by what you can verify in reality, you go by what you can't verify, and then you create false maps of reality to try to follow it around.
And then you support it with these highly complex mathematical systems.
Exactly.
Arcana. It's exactly right. Like the, you know, for the initiates in a religious sect or whatever. But I want to that term magic you mentioned. Now, magic is a term that basically initially in a certain way was a type of a technology that operated on different, you know, different planes, and we would, you know, subdivide context. But, you know, the development of modern chemistry and modern science was coming out of alchemy, right? So alchemy, these quote-unquote esoteric ideas, a lot of these spears were not necessarily removed, right, from the discourse of philosophy. Even like, you know, Hegel, you know, I've been going back and, you know, kind of digging into some of these philosophers. You know, Hegel, you know, has this idea of this world spirit, this world soul, right? And so there's this idealism, like Kantian idealism. So Kant,
sorry to interrupt, who was the largest influence into quantum physics but Kant? Mm-hmm. And then just to add one more point here, quantum physics is essentially making a lie reality by calling the lies alternate realities, and then, like you said, creating mathematical formulas to justify this stance. It's like going back to Plato's cave, since that's the opening of Plato's Republic, and they're all staring at the walls on the cave, and they all think that that's reality. And then you bring in quantum physics to map out the shadows on the cave wall as reality, and you sell those shadows on the cave wall. That's quantum physics. That, you know, that would be kind of my interpretation of it.
Well, I would say that you have the shadows on the cave wall, and then you put those shadows through a hall of mirrors and various distorting technologies, and then you fracture them into multiplicities of just whatever. And that's
that's really good, dude. You one upped me on that one. On that, good job.
Hey, man. But you know, so but basically, this stuff is fundamentally important. So Kant, you know, his basic premise is that we can't really know reality outside of us. So there must be these a priori sort of, you know, different, you know, pre-existing schemata, so to speak, of consciousness or perception, which is sort of like the Chomsky linguistic model, which views a human brain as a computer. And then basically you already have the hardware for language. And if you live in Japan, then that language cell is going to be programmed. But these models, the thing is with quantum physics, what has that done to science? How many centuries has that actually put us back? You know, all this.
Well, it's put us back at least one, because when they rolled that stuff out was about 100 years ago with the Copenhagen interpretation, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I'm thinking like how much longer?
Well, all the way. Well, yeah, for sure. And then if you go all the way back to Kant and all of his sophistry and trying to get people to believe that reality doesn't exist and to follow, you know, whims essentially, and then all the way forward to whenever other people finally realize that quantum physics is a scam. You're probably talking 300-500 years out by the time they get this fixed.
Yeah, but not even that. I'll just give an example of painting, right? So you have this development of thousands of years of technique developing, culminating in, like, you know, realist schools in England and things like that. And then suddenly you have this explosion of this abstract painting, Dada, whatever. And you suddenly have a loss of this vast body of techniques, right, that developed from the Renaissance, from Greek times, whatever, that developed. And then suddenly you got guys splattering paint on a canvas and you sold for $20, $50 million. So not only is there a future loss, right, but you have a loss of all this technique and tradition that developed. So what strands of science, Tesla or whatever, you know, of things that had developed, they got thrown out the window, right? So this, you know, the destruction of the ether is, you know, part of it, et cetera, et cetera. But I mean, you know, certainly this stuff can be resurrected, but in certain cases, there is an erasure of history as well as an erasure of the methods of transmission of knowledge, right? So even if you're learning physics, you have to go, you have a mentor, you go, you know what I mean? If you become very advanced, you're really usually learning from a single very advanced professor. For those people, you know, that go into the higher realms, it's like a, you know what I mean? It's like a craft or a passed on tradition. And so even in music, you know, you have music, you have this development of Western classical music, and then you have this atonality coming out, right? Atonality serialism, which is just taking these mathematical combinations, creating the ugliest, most dissonant music you can imagine. All these other directions from Debussy, Debussy's been in the jazz, but you have like Scriabin, you have all these other composers that were pushing a new direction, but an organically evolving direction with, you know, and we're talking about, you know, vast, you know, to write an orchestral score, which I've done. I mean, it's not easy, man. It's extremely complex, as much as anything else. So you have a loss of all that information that developed from that train of transmission. And exactly like quantum mechanics, you populate the academy with adherents of these particular schools. You shut people down. You know, in the 1950s, you have the CIA funding abstract expressionism, funding atonal music, right? And all the composition departments in American universities are controlled by serial composers, right? You know, and the fact is that at the heart of that is creating, okay, it's exactly akin to quantum physics. That's why I'm not, you know, falling off a cliff here is that, you know, when you have these comp, so basically not to get too detailed, but you have these tone rows, you create these mathematical ordered sets of pitches, and from that you create music that's highly dissonant, in fact, highly disturbing psychologically, right? You have these, so just like quantum mechanics, you have this arcania, you have this complex technology of mathematics, right? That requires, I mean, it's not easy, right? You have to learn how to do it, whatever. At the same time, you're creating these barriers in the institutions. So if you're against quantum mechanics, boom, you're not going to get published, right? If you're a composer until probably recently, and you're not following the atonal music, they're going to laugh you out of the concert hall. You won't get performed, even though it also served the function of destroying, you know, the audience for classical music primarily. You know what I mean? So it's a very similar parallel process, right? In that you create this arcania, which is actually based on kind of a destabilization. At the same time, it reaches backwards because you're disrupting the knowledge base that evolved over thousands of years, right? That culminated in all these organically developed streams of knowledge, which are transmitted usually on one-to-one basis, right, in terms of very advanced fields, are suddenly all the gatekeepers are those who have now subscribed to this new theory. And you have to go through this and you have to agree to it. And if you see problems with it, you have to like either shut your mouth or lose your degree and don't graduate, right? And then, so this is a very serious thing. And it's exactly the same process. And so you look at these strands of development, you look at the, you know, early 19th century or whatever, you know, early 20th century, and you look at these developments in physics, what have we lost? What strands of development have been completely submerged and erased from history? You know what I mean? And then, you know, and then not only that, when you go to the postmodern level, there's no longer any culture to transmit. There's nothing. There's no tradition. There's no history. There's nothing. There's this, you know what I mean, this eternal present. So anyways, yeah, that's,
What I was going to say is people interested in more on this topic can go to the Gnostic Media website and go under the Trivium Study section on the left under media categories, and they'll find two shows that I did with David Harriman called The Philosophic Corruption of Physics and The Logical Leap, which are episodes 111 and 112. And he has actually done a lot of research essentially exposing quantum physics and all of the Kantian philosophy that you're bringing up here, and how this has essentially destroyed and corrupted physics since they rolled it out, you know, back in the 1910s and 20s.
Yeah, no, exactly. And just to, you know, backtrack a little bit, we look at this rollout of the peyote of the Native American Church. You know, we have to look at several important developments. This is a bit later, but like the Golden Bough, right? You have the Golden Bough by Frazier.
Absolutely.
Extremely influential book. Right. And then you have the Cambridge Ritualists, right? The Cambridge Ritualists were a school of philosophy / anthropology / classic scholars, and they came up with this myth and ritual school, right? So you have, and then you have the 1855 book, was it Thomas Bulfinch, that also, you know, so you have this classification and understanding of mythology and ritual. And you're going through all of these different cultures and you're looking at these cultures as particular systems, but because you're taking kind of a top-down approach, right? You're not a Christian scholar criticizing Christianity from within it. You're looking at all these historical cults. At the same time, there's a development of a model of social manipulation to a certain extent that, you know, arises from that, especially this manipulation of ritual, I think is based on this understanding, right? So you have this, and then actually what's interesting is the Cambridge Ritualists, one of their most important bases was the ritual, you know, seasonal killings, you know, like the Wicker Man, right? The
right.
Yearly ritual sacrifice. But this understanding of ritual as be forming a basis for the whole society. At the same time, you go into the understanding of archetypes, of symbols, and how symbols affect the consciousness. And then if you fast forward a little bit, you go into like Walter Lippmann, and then you go into Lowen, Kurt Lowen, philosophical topology, topological psychology, I'm sorry. And that, in 1936, I think that was published, that clearly delineates the system models of the social, the society, boundaries, psychological worlds, and all this stuff. So you put all this stuff together, you start seeing a theoretical basis for all of these things. And, you know, we'll go to this a bit later, but we talk about the Grateful Dead. I would say that in the interviews and what they're talking about, they are high-level players in this. They're not coming in at a ground level. They're coming in at a top control level. You know what I mean? They're not going to have that kind of understanding or knowledge, the level of intellectual acumen that you know, both of these LSD burnouts exhibit still in the 1990s. They're keeping up with all this philosophical stuff, but the fact that what they're doing is aligning with creating, not only dismantling the formerly existing society, but installing these new rituals. And, you know, and we can go from there.
Well, I totally agree with you. And, you know, in the part two of Laying the Dead to Rest, which I'm editing now, we have that clip of the Grateful Dead playing with Hugh Hefner, you know, for the Playboy show, Playboy After Dark. And he's standing there with Hugh Hefner discussing how they have two drums on opposite sides of the room, which creates an Ouroboros effect, and the sound is chasing itself around the room between the drummers. And he's like, you know, and you want to get, it causes the brain this, and he's making this description of all this, but this isn't something that your average, you know, hippie, druggy band musician would be playing. He's obviously he's up on the latest research on stereophonics and all of this stuff to even be able to make a statement like that.
Yeah. And at the same time, that episode of the Playboy thing, that was where Hugh Hefner had an astrological reading, right?
Right.
And that is right where, you know, I won't get all the numerology of it, but you look at that when that show aired with the lunar calendar, that, you know, very rare song they played, you know, about with lots and lots of myths and symbolism in it, that relates to the Altamont, the, you know, the Manson and all that stuff. So you see that, you know, in a certain way, you could look at certain parts of the 1960s as being enacted as a ritual, following particular segments, particular types of evolution, right? And just to go back to the Golden Bough, the whole usage of, you know, LSD and all this stuff was always framed as this type of, you know, mythological journey, you know, this undertaking. Like, go back to William S. Burroughs, the Yeage Letters, right? I remember reading that when I got that when I was high school. You know, I was into the Beats and all that.
Usually they pronounce it Yage.
Yo, Yage. Yage Letters. That goes back to me, like 17. Right. But, I mean, what damage did that do? I was like, I want to get some Yage, man. Wow, that looks really great.
You know, and that's the next thing that needs to be investigated. I've been staring at this for years, Hans, this whole ayahuasca issue and where it all comes from, because the two ayahuasca churches, the Santo Daime and Uno de Vegetal, come out of the rubber industry, rubber manufacturing companies, both of them started by rubber industry workers. And then you have William Burroughs getting a letter from Richard Evan Schultes. And then he goes down there, and then he writes the Yage letters. And then you have Marlene Dobkin de Rios going down there doing a whole bunch of research on it. And then you have, surprisingly, or maybe not, Terrence and Dennis McKenna doing a huge bulk of the promotion on ayahuasca. And then today you have this global explosion of ayahuasca use for spirituality. And for those who want to see how shamanism really worked in South America. They need to read, what was it, In Darkness and Secrecy and Dark Shamans by Dr. Neil Whitehead. And he totally exposes all of this stuff as a fraud and exposes how they were doing all these dark ritualistic killings and all of this stuff. That the entire neo-shamanic theme with all the ayahuasca and mushrooms and peyote and everything else that they totally omit out of these ancient rituals. Nobody wants to talk about how the Aztecs actually used the mushrooms or teonanacatl for hypnotizing people and preparing them for human sacrifice, and that suicides were rampant in Aztec times under the influence of mushrooms.
Yeah, well, you know, that's certainly true. And I just want to, you know, bring up, you know, what you've talked about before, but there may be new listeners here who are not part of my vast empire of fans, you know, and just, you know, about ready to jump in my limo, drink some champagne. But no, basically, ayahuasca, I had some interest in it just because, and this is before we started doing interviews, but you know, I have a sort of fan relative who was very much into it and said, you know, it has all these healing properties, et cetera, et cetera. So I participated. I went to several of these ceremonies. And the first ceremony I went to, you know, I was there and in my mind had been, I had the set, right? My set was, oh, this is, you know, these are these, you know, this is the story of how it got legalized and this self-sacrificing man who did this. And so this church and all this stuff. So, okay, cool. So I go there. And at first I got there, it seemed a little bit weird. But what I just noticed was just the, I mean, you're looking at, everyone is wearing a uniform, right? So you have to wear a particular colored white suit. You have this strict segregation of male and female. And then you're sitting there, you have to read these Portuguese hymns and like try to dance samba while you're tripping. You know, your balls. And it's not easy, but it was just really, I mean, I just, and then you have this double cross, right? You have their shrine with like, there's a cross with two lines on it, you know, and all this stuff. And they have their own deities, you know. And so the first time I went, you know, I was kind of like, I was a little bit uneasy, not quite enjoying it, but I felt it had the, I thought this could be a cult or maybe it's something really good because supposedly this vine is supposed to be really healing. So I said, okay, maybe it'll take care of some of my health problems and I'm interested in this. So let me just go ahead. So then I went to another one, which is a major retreat in this, like in the middle of nowhere in Maryland, in this big farm. It's like a 3-day retreat. They flew in the special ayahuasca from like deep in the rainforest. They brought in these crates and stuff. And this was intense, man. This was a whole different level. This was, and the founder of this, you know, the Santo Daime, one of the major players here, Mr. Goldman was there as, you know, leading these rituals. You know, I don't want to get a little lawsuit, but it was, it started out kind of nice. You know, they played some like, you know, soothing kind of new age music. You got to lie down and do this, you know, meditation thing. Okay. It was pretty cool. Right. You know, and then they,
uh-oh, lost you there. Where'd you go? Hello. Hello.
Yep. Sorry, we just got it. Yeah,
so, all right. You're going to have to repeat about 10 seconds there.
Yeah. So anyway, so it started out with kind of a nice new agey kind of a feeling and some kind of jet. And then he said, they started the ritual and said, we want to encourage you to allow these entities that we summon to come into you. All different kinds of entities are going to come to you. So then they start the stuff and they're chanting and you see people just going crazy. You see people getting possessed by different entities. Now at that time I could see the entities. One guy who was an ex-con who wrote a book about discovering ayahuasca in prison supposedly got possessed by some Native American kid that was murdered there, and the guy was trying to murder me. He was literally like, ah, yeah, yeah, like trying to choke me and stuff when I was there. I mean, there was, you know, women being let out screaming. I mean, and then it reached a point where, I mean, I just, it was like one of the darkest things I ever saw. And you know, there's other, you know, details I can go into, but it was like, I'm like witnessing high level sort of a, you know, demonic satanic possession ritual in the garb of a religious expression on the last day. And then they have these guards, right? So I was trying to get out of the room. They make you keep dancing. You can't stop dancing. You know, they make you, you know, you're going, singing these weird, you know, songs. And just, and this is, it was very, very powerful. I mean, we're talking like some powerful stuff I've ever imagined to encounter. But I mean, the the end result was that, you know, by the last day I went there and everyone's wearing these purple suits with these dark ties. And I was like, this is like the Church of Satan. And at one point I thought this woman was being sacrificed. I heard this woman, they carried her out to the top of this hill. You heard her screaming. I literally thought they were sacrificing her, right? Then, you know, I was tripping, but I kept saying, when is this going to end? When is this going to end? It was totally horrible, traumatic experience. And that doesn't mean I can't handle my trip or whatever, but most of the people involved in it were all like, oh, this is so great. But number one, whether or not you believe in possession or not, what I saw there was extremely dark, was in fact, you know.
And you had told me, and we had discussed in one of the other episodes, that you saw Baphomet at one of these ayahuasca sessions.
Well, it was this session, and this one stuff started getting bad. So I went up to get my cup, right? I had the first cup. I went to get you wait in line to get the glass. I went up, and there was like a 7-foot-tall Baphomet, you know, total 3D, like fully present, you know, total detail, like as real as anything you'd see, sitting next to the guy handing out the drinks. And he was just sitting next to him, smiling at me. And this Baphomet was right there. I mean, you know, as real as anything, you know, you see Cronkite with your eyes. And he was just, and then, you know, then there's a whole thing with the Baphomet attack. But then all the you know, like I was looking like they have a Christ. The Christ, you know, changed into like a Satan. You know, the Virgin Mary became the Whore of Babylon. I started seeing all this, you know, all the pictures I had hanging around this, you know, thing started transforming into these other things. And, you know, and again, I was seeing the entities, right? And I would see them come into somebody. There's an older African-American lady. This thing came into her, and she was, you know, rather portly. She just started dancing like crazy. I mean, it was really, really, really disturbing. But at the same token, I mean, one person, I know two people from being participating in this that are now permanently institutionalized. They've gone clinically insane, probably for the rest of their lives, from participating in this, right? This guy's girlfriend, I know I don't want to say too much personal stuff on here, he went absolutely insane. And another thing that I mentioned before was there was at least two instances of killings, which appears to have been erased from the web, but there's one in Japan where they're doing the ceremony, people came back and murdered people. And there's another thing in Brazil where they, you know, during the ceremony, a couple of the participants went out and came and started hacking people to death with machetes, you know, while they're tripping. So there's at least two instances of that, of this turning into a human sacrifice ritual.
You know, a few years ago, there was a UFC fighter. I forget if it was Washington or Oregon or Northern California. He was on a mushroom trip with his buddy. And during the trip, he started freaking out. And the UFC fighter punched. I'm not kidding, Hans. I did manage to get the newspaper clips of this. Punched a hole in the guy's chest and ripped out his heart. And this did make the news. And then I sent it to Tom Roberts and these other guys that run these psychedelic news lists. Wow. And of course they don't repost, you know, these groups like, you know, Tom Roberts news groups, et cetera, only repost positive stories. They really do their best to suppress any negative stories on this stuff.
And that's exactly like with the ayahuasca, is that you see this, there's, you know, a few articles. I mean, this is now state sponsored by the, you know, the government of Brazil, right? They've accepted it as a state religion, right? It's now, you know, it's considered like a whatever, I don't know if it's UNESCO, but it's a cultural heritage type of thing, you know, there. And I found one article by a Brazilian guy talking about how this thing was, you know, part, you know, in collusion with the government, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I mean, the fact is, like, what I'm talking about is that, okay, like, what I experienced there, you know, and like I said, I've experienced quite a lot. I've seen many possession rituals all over the world. I've been in India. I've seen, you know, these different things. I never saw anything close to that. I've seen things that most people would.
Sorry, I was just showing that. Oh, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, most people would, you know, not even want to even go close to. So I'm saying that I'm talking from a level that you know, there is something going on here. And especially if you look at this idea, which is, we brought this up before, but this idea of, you know, creating, which, you know, the Mary Pranksters talk about, you know, creating this sort of, you know, everyone, these tubes running in everyone's head, you know, this group collective mind, and you're feeding ideas into people's minds. So it creates this sort of this ability to transmit, whether it's energy or thought forms or whatever it may be. But this ripping the beating heart out, where did he get that idea? That's something, and this guy doesn't look like he's read a book in his life. He may have, but he obviously is probably with ancient Aztec sacrifice rituals, right? And so you have these things that are being deployed and that are actually...
Well, yeah, and what's the irony of that, that this is what the Aztecs actually used the mushrooms for, and they would go, you know, and use these jade knives and rip these guys' chests open and rip out their still beating hearts, and here this guy is doing exactly that.
Yeah, and you wonder where he got the idea. And how that would happen. I mean, that's not a common thing to do. You could break someone's neck. You could, you know, I mean, that seems like that's a lot of work. But to do that, obviously, he wanted to get the guy's heart, right? He was compelled to do it by a very, you know what I mean? That's, you know what I mean? There's
very dark something or other.
Exactly, exactly. And so, you know, you have this whitewashing at the same time, you know, you have these invented traditions, invented rituals, right? And this is something that's very common, right? You have all different kinds of things that are created and sort of given a pseudo past or appear to have emanated from, you know, thousands of years ago. And there's lots and lots of examples of this, you know, from, you know, in the political spectrum, you know, just being utilized on a, just a basic level of, you know, rituals, maybe American rituals or whatever that may be, or American myths, you know, et cetera. But, the fact is that, you know, you have this understanding of the importance of ritual, but, you know, the Cambrian ritualists, you know, I mean, again, the ritual, the sacrifice, this ritual sacrifice, this idea, I mean, and again, like films like, The Wicker Man, which Michael Hoffman in his book, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, kind of links the Wicker Man film to, like, you know, some of these, like, serial killings and not the Zodiac Killer, but the other one. But whatever. So you have these serial killings and all this stuff in America. Again, these are deployments of types of rituals. But let's look at the 1960s, right, as an inverse ritual, right? Why is that an inverse ritual? It's sort of a dark ritual. I mean, if you look at it with, you know, Kennedy assassination, then suddenly the Beatles coming, you know, rock and roll being a liberation, right? So you have this, you know, in the ritual, you know, you have the separation, the journey, and then the return, right? So you have this, you know, these three stages, you know, go through the hero's journey, which is also the ritual process, right? The stages of ritual process. And this has profound, you know, psychological impacts. I mean, I think this is kind of hardwired, even though maybe it sounds like I'm becoming a Chomskyite, but I mean, you know, the ritual process, you see this in graduation ceremonies, you see this all over the place, right? But you look at the 1960s as a ritual, as a collective social ritual, you have this, you know, okay, you have this, you know, the killing of the king, you know, that whole, you know, the Masonic thing of the king, killing of the king, you know, they have the 33 parallel, you know, what in Dallas, whatever, and then you have this salvation through rock. And very quickly, you have the Beatles, these clean-cut, scrubby kids, are very quickly, you know, just a couple of years later, you got Revolver, you've got the psychedelic aspect moving in. And very soon, 1963, though, was just right when the you know, psychedelics started to, you know, come through, you know, even it had started a bit earlier with the folk scene, but you have, you know, psychedelics starting to really come into the quote counterculture, right? Starting in 63. So you have all this stuff, you know, Mary Pranksters, all this stuff starting right around the same time, you know, and this is brought up. I'm not just bringing this up as a, you know, as a armchair analyst, but many people, you know, in the 1960s, they talk about that. You know, John F. Kennedy had died. We had no more direction in America, and we wanted to, you know, we had lost our way. You know, the American dream had been shattered, whatever you know what I mean? So it's a very common quote, but it's actually a psychological reality, right? You have this mass inflicted trauma. Then you have this very quick evolution from entertainment escapism, Beatles being escapism. Then suddenly you have this deeper level, and the psychedelic stuff was kind of started out as kind of just let's have fun and let's be trippy. But then, of course, you have Huxley from the other end pushing this idea of, you know, this is a means of enlightenment or social transformation. And you have all, you know, SRI, Stanford Research along all these other things coming up around the same time from multiple tiers, right? You have the ground level, popular culture level, it's coming up like this. Then you have the top down, you know, sort of scientific analytical model, right? Being deployed at the same time. But you look at the 60s as a hero's journey. The hero comes, you know, 1967, summer of love, anything is possible. We can do it, man. We can change the world, man. We can do it, baby. Come on, it's so groovy, man. It's just tripping. If everyone just tripped all day, we'd be enlightened.
And well, don't forget free love.
Well, free, of course, that's just one aspect. Free right. love, you know, returning to a neo-tribal model, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, these are mostly wealthy kids. And of course, as we know, the 1960s music, you had cheap gasoline so you could travel around the country in your internal combustion engine vehicle. And then you had electricity. So the music itself is based on electricity, you know, as opposed to going back to nature. So I think even Bob Dylan going electric, I think that's far more important than people would realize. If you look at in a more graphic example of Molly Cyrus going from, you know, the cuddly girl next door to the ultimate, you know, harlot.
Or Babylon.
Or Babylon.
She well, has and, well, how about Bob Zimmerman Dylan getting the quote-unquote Nobel Prize this week? I mean, what, you know, you can't get a bigger joke than that, right?
He got the Nobel Prize.
Yeah, he did this week, and it's a total joke. I had it sent to me by like four or five people all within like 10 or 20 minutes.
In what? Plagiarism or singing out of tune? Which is
Let's see here. I will pull it up, and let's see. You can keep talking while I pull it up.
Yeah, so anyway, so you look at the, you know, inverse ritual of the 60s, so you have this, you have, look at Spock.
Mr. Okay, sorry, here it is. So this is from CNN here, and I'll just share the screen here. So, no joke, everybody can see this nonsense. Bob Dylan wins Nobel Prize for Literature. So, I mean, you know, and what kind of, oh, and what kind of literature is he even writing that's worth a crap? It's all degenerate nonsense. I mean, that would be like giving Allen Ginsberg the Nobel Prize because he could did a little kids.
Yeah, that's kind of surprising. I mean, Dylan, you know, like say like Masters of War, that's a great song, but there's many, many instances of Dylan not only plagiarizing, but also using this kind of random rhyme scheme he had to write his stuff. And because it's so obscure, it seems like it's deep. At the same time, just as the first Laying the Dead the Rest episode, we played that that example from the TV station where they're talking in this Ericksonian hypnotic language with embedded commands where it kind of makes sense of the conscious mind, but it makes sense enough that it seems like it's really deep, but you don't want to admit you don't understand it, but you feel like you're getting something out of it, but it's embedded hypnotic commands. I have not researched Dylan's lyrics enough to make that statement, but the fact is that, you know what? I mean, he had a lot of garbage stuff. He certainly does not deserve a Nobel Prize for Literature. I mean, that's a travesty. He's a lyricist. He, you know, if there's like, you know, okay, a lifetime Grammy Award for songwriting, sure, but hell no.
Nobel Prize. Maybe a Doctor of Letters or some crap, you know. But, I mean, they gave Enya and Pink Floyd Doctor of Letters. That's the highest doctor's degree you can have. Maybe give them something like that. But a Nobel Prize, it's like giving Obama the Nobel Prize because he's black and elected. And meanwhile, he's been this total communist tyrant president that's committed as many atrocities as every other.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's actually shocking that Dylan, I'm actually stunned that he would get a Nobel Prize in Literature, because how many great poets, right, I could name 20 amazing poets that ended their lives in poverty. Did Dylan Thomas get a Nobel Prize for Literature? If he didn't, because he was a great poet, right? Or you've got, I mean, whatever. I mean, poetry, to write poetry is basically, unless you get a college gig, you're going to starve. I mean, I happen to like poetry, but you know, Dylan is, I mean, that's an obscenity. I'm sorry to say that.
Yes, I sorry to upset you. I didn't mean to interrupt your whole thought process by sophistry and diatribe.
I wish I had a little beeper button so I could just swear and beep beep, you know.
Well, this is CCN, so you're free to swear on this show.
Well, Jan, I don't want to do that.
All right. We'll keep it PG, ladies and gentlemen. You can take your hands off your children's ears.
All right, mofos, let's hit it now. But so anyways, back to the ritual in the 1960s. So I'm going to throw this in. Look at all these cultural currents that are changing. You have the stuff in cinema that's coming up, right? You have all this stuff from the 1950s, of course, being brought to another level. But look at, just thinking about this, Dr. Spock from Star Trek, which was a major influence on people. And then Dr. Spock, the child-rearing expert, where you basically let your kids do whatever the hell they want, right? This idea of child-rearing, where you just let them freak out. There's no, you don't punish them. They can go do whatever they want.
You don't give them any structure whatsoever.
And this is Dr. Spock, okay, in the show. But so I could go through 50 different influences, right? But just keeping it relatively compact. You move, and then you have this, you have the initial trauma, Kennedy assassination, then you have the Beatles, and it's on the explosion of popular culture as entertainment. You have the morphing of popular cultural celebrities to an almost spiritualized status as iconic figures. Like
Jerry Garcia.
Yeah, well, I mean, Jerry and they talk about that as we are the new family. Family structure is dead, and we are the new family. But the family is one level, but then you have these icons, people basically worshiping them, right? They're seen as these mentors, these myth makers, these gurus, right? These people that are mapping out the territory of the mind. At the same time, like Ken Kesey, his famous anti-war speech, you know about that. He went there and basically said, you guys are idiots. Just take LSD. Don't be involved in politics, blah, blah, blah. Mr. Ken Kesey with his, mental mind control manipulation experiments where he's lauded as this happy-go-lucky, really nice guy, which is, again, making people, even if you cause one person to go clinically insane or have one person gang raped at your acid test. I mean, if that happened, I would feel guilty the rest of my life, but how many people went clinically insane because of the acid test? Probably hundreds. There's no documentation. We don't know, right? But anyways.
Of course, everybody wants to parade that nonsense around like the 60s happened organically. And, people aren't even willing to look at the obvious facts, the Kesey and the Grateful Dead. I mean, acid tests. Hello, folks. It was part of MKUltra. They were all agents.
Yeah, as I said, Mountain Girl says this guy borrowed the equipment from his brother from his Stanford Research Institute and brought it down this, highly expensive sound equipment. But anyways, we move from there. And then so we have this, same time we have the Vietnam War coming in, so we have at the same time there's the trauma is there, but then you get this state of spiritual transcendence, right? There's not only a spiritually transcendent state, but there's idea that, again, that we can change the world. Kill your parents, as Abby Hoffman said, kill anyone over 30, right? Instead of respecting elders, you're disrespecting them. And then you have this indoctrination that by taking LSD, you're achieving a superior state of consciousness. You're transforming the world by tripping out, by taking LSD. You're transforming.
By doing nothing.
You're transforming the fabric of reality, right? But then at the same time, there's this empowerment where we're going to, we're going to make this world, something completely new and all this stuff, right? So you have this euphoria, you have these major traumas, you have this massive euphoria, and suddenly like a brick wall, boom, and this is why, you have the Zodiac killing starting, which is all throughout the media, which is a major media operation. You have, of course, the Manson killings. You have Altamont, which is, the symbolic end of the 60s, which is actually designed. That was a ritual that aligned completely with all of everything else that went before. And the fact is that this, what you actually have created, is a psychological laboratory. But as Jerry says, which we'll get into that on third episode, he says every 30 years this stuff repeats. So right now in Eastern Europe, the revolutions in Eastern Europe are coming from our 1960s. So every 30 years these time cycles repeat and we roll out this stuff and this mythology and this energy will be redeployed, right? But this whole 1960s is really, is seen as the era when we were free, the era when, we finally gave it to the man, and if things had not just got shut down, we would have changed the world. No, but you look at it, you have STP, these really dark trips people are going on. Woodstock, what a nightmare being a Woodstock, right? Look how that sold. People with the worst, thanks to Mr. Wavy Gravy, this horrible LSD. then you have, but then right after that, you have the rolling of all
was that wavy gravy that dispensed the bad acid?
Yes, it was.
It was.
The hog farm. Yeah, it was coming through his hog farm minions.
I didn't know the bad acid was from him. Wow, that's really interesting because, you know, his name is Hugh Natin Romney. Yeah, he was U.S. Army.
He was there at the beginning. He was there with the folk movement.
You know, and get this, you know, so he goes on to help found the Seva Foundation, but he's hanging out with Albert Einstein, who is working with the Huxleys, creating all this stuff. And then the hog farm, they always have to throw in the not-so-subtle swine reference for all of the goyim who were playing in the mud at the concert, you know.
Yeah. Well, I just saw the movie. I was in a hotel the other day. I saw the movie Carrie. What a piece of garbage, man. That movie just sucked ass. I'm sorry to say. I just did some filmmaking. You know, but Stephen King's Carrie, that whole thing, you look at that, it starts out with this underage girl taking a nude shower, right? And then she has her period and da-da-da. And then, you know, everyone makes fun of her at the school. And she's psychic. And then she has this sort of pseudo-romance. And then they dump pig's blood on her head. And she goes insane and kills everybody. That's the movie. But you look at that film, that film is a psychological warfare product. And so if you start going through all the different confluences of the media, look at the monkeys. Look at they had the rock star as idol set up for kids, right? So you're looking at what to do with your life. You're seeing the rock star as the ultimate evolution, as the hero, as the winner, as the, you know, as you said, oh, you live like a rock star. I mean,
and then you prop them up, you know, way beyond what their status normally would be.
Just like sports. I mean, you're paying.
And you repeat the songs over and over and over and over on the radio until they become pop hits, even if they're garbage. And you manufacture this whole cult following of these false idols, these false alphas.
Yeah. And then at the same time, you lock people. I think the first Unspun I did with you, you said, you know, is music the most powerful means of mind control? It's like, well, we have to, but in a certain way, it might be because it's invisible, because it informs. I mean, I'm starting to get a much more deep model of this, which if I start going into it, it'll, you know, it's a little bit too much. But the idea, if you look at the understanding of psychological space internally and externally, right? And you look at music and certain types of songs and certain specific songs and certain genres of music and certain eras of music as being inextricably linked with this particular historical period, but with all kinds of all the other stuff we've just been talking about. And then you continually follow the stuff into people's brains, and then you have all your adolescent associations, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, then you talk about the erotic crystallization theory, which I found from Anton LaVey, right? And this is the idea that you're basically sort of your first erotic experience, your first sexual experience, whatever, you're kind of locked into that time period. That's kind of the core of who you are. So, for example, if you first, I'll just be blunt, if you first got laid at a Ramones concert, you're wearing a leather jacket or whatever, according to, Anton LaVey of the Church of Satan, if you go put on your Ramones jacket and play Ramones music, you'll be able to unearth that hidden energy in your life from that erotic crystallization. But this, I was wondering, where do you come up with this idea? It comes up with a biological model of society, right? Where societies go through particular periods, and you have a period of sort of crystallization, right? Where we have like a chemical model of society, right? So you have a period of crystallization where these forms become solidified, right? So these forms of music and the music being deployed creates this kind of crystallization of a almost like a top-down imposition of our models of past, present, future, who we are, what we can and can't do, you know what I mean, et cetera. Even our models of relationship, how we relate to our parents, how we relate to the opposite sex, what we view the goals of life are, et cetera, et cetera. And these become sort of crystallized or instilled or installed, you know, almost all around us. You can look at it as these are almost like exactly, you know, I mean, these are almost like beaming in the messages from the group mind computer. Stay in these bounds. Here's, you know, and this is affecting you 99% subconscious, maybe 99.99% absolutely subconscious influence on people. You know what I mean? And then you have the fact that people are becoming more and more dissociated, disconnected, right, from their own sensory modalities, moving into the virtual universe and stuff like that, right? So you have a very powerful deployment. But just sorry, back to my initial point. So the 60s ritual, instead of the hero's journey being a way out, you got uplifted, you went through the transition, and then your return to society. The return to society became the breakdown, became the shattering of the individual, the shattering of the illusions, the shattering of dreams and visions. Then you move into the me generation of the 70s, where everybody is going into self-help, you know, whatever, you know, women are running off, leaving their kids. I'm going to Australia to find myself and play didgeridoo with the Australian natives.
Yeah. You know what I mean? But then, and that was rampant too. You know, people actually bought into that crap.
And that funnels into what? It funnels into the 1980s, Wall Street, right? This idea of just make all the money you can. Lie as much as you need to. There's no truth. You know what I mean? And you have all, of course, the 60s guys going into the stock zone, right? And all this stuff. So if you look at it as something.
Maybe that's why Jim Morrison wanted to be a stockholder after he faked his death, you know?
Yeah. Well, I am the Lizard King. I can do anything.
Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, I just, yeah, Jim Morrison. But so I'm trying to actually get to some of these underpinnings and looking at some of the intellectual support for this. And in Cambridge, and just one guy influenced by the Cambridge School who was a sociologist, Cornford, F.N. Cornford, who actually married Frances Darwin, daughter of Sir Francis Darwin. So they're connected with Darwin, Freud, and stuff like that. So, these models, right? You know, this and this idea of ritualistic killing, the king kill, the wicker man, all this ritual sacrifice. You know, like you said, I mean, that's the interesting thing. You tie the mushrooms into that kind of a cult, right? A blood and death cult, right? And one thing to say is that when you have a society like that, right, society like a Mayan society, you don't really have any past or future, right? You're trapped in this eternal present that's connected with these ritual cycles, these calendrical cycles you're related to, seasonal cycles, you know what I mean? But you're not, you know what I mean? So you get locked into this thing. And then, then you look at the ossification, the crystallization of mass psychology, right? Then you start to freeze the social. You start to freeze the mind. You start to freeze the emotional development. You have these adolescents. What is a rock star? Who the hell is Mick Jagger? He's a goddamn adolescent prancing
around. And then we see exactly why they are reinventing, recreating, re-implementing the Aztec religion. Today, taking it right out of the Florentine Codex and putting it on people. And people think, oh, well, it's so spiritual because the Aztecs did it and they were brown people, so it's got to be a good thing. But this was, Montezuma had a massive empire. He had his priest class that were the mind controllers of the population. And the priest class are the ones that carved out people's hearts and gave them mushrooms to do these sacrifices. And all of this is omitted from this history, and you just said it spot on. It was a death cult. And what they've done is the death cult's biggest trick was to remarket itself 400 years later as a peace and love cult. And we have about 2 minutes left.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely correct, Jan. And I think that's what makes it so interesting. It's not only weaponized anthropology, it's weaponized religion, it's weaponized psychology, but also it's based on the fact that most people aren't going to read between the lines, understand what's going on, what's the postmodern philosophical basis of our contemporary world. You know what I mean? They're not going to bother, they're not going to know anything. We don't have any education. But just say, check out my website, hansutter.com. I've got some CDs. So please help me, with that. I want to definitely continue this research. It's certainly, it definitely ruffles some feathers in the music world, but hey, I'm still going, I think that this is, you're really on some with this. And I think it's absolutely fascinating.
Well, you're definitely onto some good stuff too, and we've been exposing it for like going on like 2 years now. We just keep going with all of this. Oh, and speaking of which, next week I'm going to re-release last year's War of the Worlds episode because it will be Halloween, and I mean, we can't really top that Halloween episode, so might as well roll it back out. And I will have the new Laying the Dead to Rest Part 2 done as soon as possible, and I'll get busy on working on it tonight. Please support Gnostic Media. Make a donation at GnosticMedia.com. Also, please support the network. That's CCN. And so thank you, Hans, so much. And anything else you want to add before we say goodbye to everyone?
No, it was, well, it was a real pleasure. And the thing is that I want to say that we have the means of retaking the stuff in our hands. There are certain areas. You're not going to shut down state power and the surveillance grid. But if you get into this level of the psychology and consciousness, you can start to puncture and shatter this stuff. And I think that's why this stuff, the quote-unquote soft stuff, is actually much more potent than the violence.
All right. Until next week, thank you so much, Hans. See you then, everyone, and good night.
Be seeing you.
Thank you for tuning into CCN. This unique network is dedicated to free and independent media. CCN was created with the belief that information is the common heritage of all beings, which is why our live stream high-definition broadcast is easily accessible and free to view. If we want to change the world, we must first change the media. Having produced over 1,000 shows in 2015, which are all archived on YouTube, we look forward to bringing you more groundbreaking, cutting-edge information in 2016. For more information on what is on, please check out our broadcast guide for weekly updates. CCN broadcasts in multiple languages and features some key voices of our challenging times who are all in pursuit of a free, fair, just, sustainable world. CCN belongs to you, the people, and it is up to you all to keep this network on the air. Please contribute to the Network Support Fund or visit the CCN shop. We thank you all for supporting free and independent media.